Thank you very much for that, Nikki. Lots of things to think about in that, and very, very interesting. Before I open it up to the floor, I thought I would invite the other panellists to speak for a few minutes and just give some thoughts in reaction to what Nikki has said, and probably some ideas of their own in terms of direction that we should go with. And if I could invite Maya to kick us off on that.
Thank you, Ray, and thank you for inviting me. I need to tell you just briefly what you need to know about me, which is I work in international development, and my main contribution to this debate so far has been to tell my colleagues working in campaigning NGOs and in donor organisations not to get too carried away with the idea that there are billions and trillions of dollars of money for the poorest countries from tax avoidance and evasion. Yes, it is a real issue, but no, it isn't the pot of gold that people have sometimes thought it was. So that's sort of how I come to be here. And the idea of properly informed and evidence-based debate, both on UK tax policy and on the role of international tax for development is something that I'm strongly supportive of. Nikki talked about sort of why tax has become such a public issue, and I think certainly the financial crisis, the reaction to the financial crisis was part of that. But I think there are probably three reasons why people are, you know, talking about transfer pricing and double Irish Dutch sandwiches over their breakfast cereal. I think, firstly, it is a real issue. It is still a real issue. The base erosion and profit shifting reforms of the OECD and the G20 have gone some way to addressing the vulnerabilities in the international tax system, but it's clear that it is still struggling in the face of globalized and digital businesses. Secondly, I think it's always an easier conversation for politicians to have with the public to say, you know, would you like someone else to pay more tax for public services than to say, would you like to pay more tax for public services? And thirdly, because of four guys working out of a garden shed who nobody saw coming, and that's the Tax Justice Network, which started in 2003 and was probably ignored largely by the profession, but has played a huge role in raising these issues up the agenda, partly by convincing the development organisations that have, much larger, organisations like Oxfam and Christian Aid and so on, that have brand, that have trust, that have the ability to mobilise and communicate with people to take this issue on. And I think those three factors really played a big role in making this a public issue. And, now things like the anti-money laundering bill, which is going to force UK overseas territories to have public registers of beneficial ownership, the speed and ambition of the BEPS project, all of that, I think in some ways can be traced or has been contributed to by the UK NGOs and kind of four guys who started this agenda in a garden shed in Norfolk. But having said that, when I talk to people in the profession, what I hear is a sense of frustration with the state of the public debate, that it's not informed, it's not evidence-informed, it's not constructive, but at the same time a recognition that a public debate is needed, and that it's no longer enough to say, trust the experts, tax is an expert subject, it's very technical, and that things like fairness and equity, which are quite difficult for tax professionals to, which are not part of your toolkit, but are what people in the public domain want to talk about, need to come into that debate. So I think I'm really glad that you've invited me here. I know that there are lots of people in this room who have been part of these debates, who invite people from the development sector and the campaigning sector onto their panels, who go and speak to their forums, and I think that's really really positive. I think things like the select committees are really important, but so are the debates that go on beyond that, and the extent to which they can support that to be a constructive debate. So I hope that in this year, Ray, you'll be continuing to host and build on those.
Thank you, Maya. Heather?
Thanks, Ray. I was nearly late tonight because I think I got on the tax policy bus. It went very slowly and didn't seem to be getting anywhere, and then it got diverted. As Ray mentioned at the beginning, I've been doing tax policy work for an awfully long time and sometimes think that I'm not getting anywhere very fast. And then I think about the Institute for Fiscal Studies, which was founded in outrage at how complicated the 1965 Finance Act was. And I'm alternatively comforted or even more despairing at that thought. But the public debate and the work of committees such as the Treasury Select Committee and the fact that there is so much public interest in tax surely gives us an opportunity to get somewhere with this debate. And I'd like to suggest three key questions that we might touch on during our Q&A. The first is, for all of us collectively, how can we bring the debate onto common ground and stop? This is a room full of tax professionals. I love you all. I love debating with tax professionals. But how do we have a debate with the public, between NGOs and tax professionals and politicians? Can we find a way to have a collective debate? Are we using technology enough to do that? One of the most positive things about the OECD BEPS programme for me was that when they had a proposal, they had a public webinar that you could dial into from your desk and you could ask questions on Twitter, on email, or whatever. And that sense of really getting proper engagement is something which I think we could do more of. For the CIOT, it's the leading professional body concerned solely with taxation, and it's an educational charity. I fully support the themes that Ray set out in his speech earlier this afternoon about the CIOT taking a leading role in this debate. But are we doing enough to initiate debate on key policy issues? It's great, Nikki, that we've now got the consultation tracker, but it's also, again, discouraging when you see just how many documents that politicians would like us all to respond to, mostly in our spare time, it has to be said. When I was chairing the technical committee, one of the things I'm most proud of is that I set up a separate policy subcommittee, and its remit was that it was not allowed to respond to any consultative documents. Its role was to think about what ought to be being consulted on and to ask the hard questions. So as an institute, I think we have a responsibility to ask the hard questions and make sure that we are debating the issues that need to be debated. And finally, for each of us individually, do we leave it to others or do we actually contribute ourselves? Perhaps we can't go and give evidence to a select committee, but we could spare 10 minutes to explain to a journalist the difference between turnover and profit again. And if we see really poor practice by somebody who's perhaps not a member of our professional body, do we just go, oh, not again, or do we do something about it? And as Ray is very aware, a friend and I jointly referred a very poor quality advert to HMRC, the Solicitors Regulatory Authority, the Bar Standards Board, and then my friend then took it to the Advertising Standards Authority. There is an article about the whole backstory in taxation if you want to read it. But we both felt that this was just a ridiculous advert for a scheme that was not going to work, and all it was going to do was defraud the public. And we thought we'd had enough. It might have been late on a Sunday evening after a glass of wine on Twitter, but there you go. So my view is that we can all do things to move this debate forward, and please, let's seize the opportunity and do it.
Thank you, Heather. Stella?
Thanks, Ray. So I'm going to pick up some themes that I think everybody so far has mentioned. And I was lucky enough to be here last year, and we talked about trust and the role that we all play in building trust with the public, and that's very much a theme that's come through here. So I think we do have a vital role in delivering a sustainable tax system, and I think everybody in this room really cares about delivering a sustainable tax system. Now, it's a big challenge, but I think it's something that we're all trying very hard to live up to. Nikki mentioned the PCRT, and that's really important about the way that we operate. It's not just about the way that we govern ourselves, it's not just about the way we live up to our code of conduct, but it's the way that we communicate, it's the way that we engage with our stakeholders. It's not just about the way that we talk to our clients. We're about more than that. So I talked last year about the fact that we do here at PwC, we do engage with the public. We try to talk about tax to people that don't ordinarily talk about tax. And we talked about some citizens' juries. Well, I'm pleased to say that we've been running some new citizens' juries. So I thought I would use this opportunity to talk about the kind of things that we've learned from engaging with the public about what they care about on the tax agenda. Now, most of it isn't rocket science, and I think if I'd asked you all to put your hands up about what kind of things they might talk about, you could probably guess them. But it is quite sobering when you look at the results of an inquiry like the ones that we've done. We ran two juries in two different cities, and it was made up of a broad selection of members of the public. It kind of covered different people, different race, different gender, different age, different employment status, and different political leanings, and different understandings about tax, tax policy, and how tax works. Now, there were a bunch of different themes that came out. Quite clearly, the deepest knowledge and the greatest level of engagement came from the things that people were aware of the taxes they paid, so on income tax and council tax. Now, not only was that the greatest level of engagement and understanding, it was the thing that they were most passionate about as well when it came to tax. The other thing that was really clear is where they get their information from on tax, and I think this touches on something that Heather has just touched on. The main place where they get their information about tax, what it means, how it works, how it affects them, isn't just what they feel and what they hear, it's what they read in the newspapers. Mm. So if that's the main source of where they're getting information from, then again, coming back to Heather's point, doesn't it make sense for us to try and engage and help kind of discussions in the media more generally? I think it does. The other thing that was really clear is that the sense of the way that people kind of latched onto tax and the way that they tried to understand the meaning. Now, we talked about different scenarios, and we'd actually use Brexit as an example, looking at how could you use tax policy to shape the economy going forward, what would be good, what would be bad for these cities and these people. And actually, they didn't really care about all of that future-looking stuff because they were more concerned that some of the things working today wasn't working. What really mattered to them was the things that they could touch and they could feel and they could make sense of locally. So we sat back and we thought, well, what does that mean then about the way that we engage with people? Well, we have to kind of try and talk about tax in a way that is incredibly relevant. I don't think we do that at the moment. You know, I don't think it's right that we think because we're an expert, we can talk about tax and it will mean something and people will listen. It was quite sobering from the citizens' juries that we've just done that that's just not the case. The things that people cared most about were the NHS, were housing, the impact of automation, and generational divides. So it seems to me that if we can talk about tax in a way of trying to solve some of those issues, or the impact of tax and tax policy on some of those issues, we just might get a bit more traction. But I think we need to make it local as well. We need to not do it in a highfalutin way, talking about high-level things. We need to try and make it meaningful for different people. So we had a jury in Manchester and a jury in London. And if we were able to talk about things and make them relevant for the people in those cities, the difference in the engagement and the understanding and the feedback we got was immense. So for me, I think our contribution is quite broad. We need to talk about tax, but we need to talk about tax in a way that is relevant. And to do that, we need to make sure that we're representative of the people that we're talking to and with as well. So I think, Ray, you've made a fantastic first step with your panel, because if we're not making sure that we're talking at least to half of the population, then that's going to be a problem in itself. So I think it's down to all of us to try thinking about if we're going to make a difference, and as Heather said, if we're going to challenge ourselves to do something differently, how are we going to do it, who are we going to engage with, and what are we going to engage on? And I think the things that we've been thinking about and doing, and I'm one of them, over the last few years, might need to change radically, otherwise we're not really going to make a difference.
Thank you, Stella. I mean, if I could just make a comment, there's been quite a lot of references to PCRT, professional conduct in relation to tax. We changed that. I'll give you an example. In 2004, I spoke to the CIT's Cambridge conference. I was still in the revenue at the time, and I spoke on DOTAS. And stupidly, I agreed to take some questions at the end of my session and was completely bombarded, not with questions on DOTAS as such, but on questions as to why tax policy was always drafted badly. And the point I made in answer to that was actually quite a simple point. And actually, when I think about it, it's what PCRT is intended to stop. The point I made was there is no tax code in the world, no matter how well written, no matter how much time is put into it, can withstand 30,000 people who have a single purpose of tearing it to bits as soon as it's published and trying to find the loopholes and ways around it. And that's what we saw in this country over the last 25 years. People taking the tax code and finding ways to use it to the advantage of their clients in a way that parliamentarians would never have intended if they looked at it. And we come up with a lot of, you know, we come up with a lot of comment that it doesn't get enough scrutiny and so on. But the reality is just that. And PCRT was to draw a line and say that type of behaviour is just no good. And the message that I gave this afternoon, that we, with the other professional bodies that we work with, many of whom are here tonight, the journey hasn't stopped in terms of where that line is. And if we find that it's not effective in terms of getting tax advisers to recognise that they do have a higher responsibility to the tax system as a whole, then we will move that line to make sure that it works. Good. Thank you, ladies. Thank you, Nicky.
Pleasure.
I'd like to throw the discussion open to the floor. I think we've got some roving mics. Claire has got mic in hand, so to speak. And Peter.
Thank you. Peter Rainey. Question really for Nicky. I do think the COT being an educational body, obviously very near to our hearts, that's the education in tax. And as part of my role on the sort of, we've got an education committee, we think that more should be done at a very basic level, i.e. in schools, to educate children about how our tax system works, why we have a tax system. I mean, I know HMRC are trying to push this forward and they've produced some really good videos, yeah, haven't they? But I do think it should be compulsory on our syllabus in to teach children about tax. Yeah, and actually responsible, responsibilities about tax.
Yeah, look, I don't disagree with the premise of the question at all. I think from this September, we're going to see PHSE introduced back. I mean, many schools have already done something akin to that for many years, but back into, formally, into the secondary school curriculum. And the E at the end, the economic bit, can be interpreted in all sorts of different ways. I suppose the... when I was Education Secretary, if I had a pound for every time somebody said, schools need to do this, then honestly, the teachers and the pupils would never go home. And so it's trying to balance what schools are, you know, obviously there to do, to instill knowledge, to, after this, I'm going off to a dinner to talk about character education, you know, to build up, you know, strong, confident, resilient young people who have learnt things that are going to inspire them for their future careers. But you're absolutely right, of course, confidence about finances and about the way the world... I mean, the tax argument or discussion can come very much into, and I think we still need to have it as adults, which is who pays tax, you know, where does it go, what does it fund? I mean, it is part of a much broader debate when I'm trying to explain in the Brexit context, actually, if you squeeze off certain industries so they're not making any profits anymore, so they're not going to pay any taxes, that's an awful lot of schools and hospitals that aren't going to be funded. I have more success, I would say, with the sixth form in terms of making that argument than I do with other people in this country in terms of them believing that I don't have some sort of secret agenda or secret pot of money. And the other thing I would just say is, if you're going to introduce things into the curriculum, which I think, again, is right, we just need to think about who's going to teach it, because... you know, teachers are teachers, they're teachers of their subjects. They may very well be able, you know, that we are encouraging other people from other professions to potentially think about going into to teaching. But actually teaching tax policy or the way the economy works well and in an engaged way that people are going to retain is a skill in itself. And that may very well be where members of the profession or retired members of the profession or those who are school governors or other links with schools can play a very, very valuable part in bringing it to life. So I think, as I say, I agree with the premise. The question is delivery, doing it well, not putting people off. But it can also be a source of obviously finding great people for the future of the profession as well.
I mean, just to follow up from that, I mean, the two videos I'm thinking of that we were shown were brilliant. Yeah. I think they should be widely exposed, as it were.
Yeah, I shall take that away. Thank you.
Ray and Peter, could I just let you know that somewhere in the Institute's archives, and if not on the shelf in my study, is a video called Tax Talking, produced in, I think, 2001, John, starring Mr. John Whiting, with a brief appearance by the then Chancellor of the Exchequer. Perhaps we should dust that off and see whether the Institute could perhaps produce three-minute YouTube videos or something short that would be accessible. And again, why aren't we using the technology to reach out to the people who use it?
Brilliant.
Thank you. Patricia.
Thank you very much. I'm Patricia Caputo, but this question is actually from Keith Gordon.
Right.
tin helmets.
He says he's very sorry not to be with you tonight. And this question is for Nikki. What is more important, HMRC getting tax or HMRC acting fairly? Should HMRC ask for information they are not strictly entitled to, without making clear the lack of legal basis for their request?
Well, he's a barrister. Right. I think I'm very interested to hear other panel members' views on this as well. I think you've gone to the heart of something there, which I sort of alluded to in my talk, which is the way that HMRC operates and the way that, I mean, again, you'll interact with them as a profession on one level, but the way I'd say the ordinary taxpayer, and we're all that as well, feel that HMRC goes about their business. And I'm very conscious, I don't want to criticise, because I think HMRC in many ways have a difficult job to do, and we all know of people who will be deliberately obstructive because they know that they've done the wrong thing or not paid what they should have done and everything else. But there are also, I'm sure we've all come across, instances of people who have tried to do the right thing. Perhaps they should have taken more advice or more time or more thought, but actually then suddenly find themselves in really hot water with HMRC and treated absolutely appallingly. And I think the honest truth is that HMRC should operate within the bounds of the law and the regulatory, the perimeter that has been set for them, by Parliament, by the Treasury, because actually that even playing field, you will call it the rule of law, potentially, depending on the situation we're talking about, that everybody is bound by the same rules, is really, really important and goes to the heart of this fairness debate, which is what I hear from taxpayers and constituents more than anything else. There is a feeling that somehow, as I say, the small, ordinary taxpayer has HMRC coming crashing down on them for sending in their tax return. It could well be late, but how late? But the person who's able to afford some real swanky, law firm or tax advisor is able to get away with an awful lot more. And that doesn't seem fair to people. And that's when I think HMRC has to think very carefully about the way that they are treating different people.
Next.
Yeah.
Stephen.
Thank you, Stephen Herring. Nikki, in the gaps between watching Premiership football and test matches, I've watched most of the Treasury Committee on Parliament TV, and fascinating stuff it is as well. One of the things from watching all of it that I come out with really two impressions. Firstly, some really excellent questioning on individual matters, which where, broadly speaking, probably 90% of them I agree with the member of the committee, whatever party they're from, the questions they're asking. But I also think there is a gap there, and the gap is the challenge to the government on making sure that the UK has the most competitive tax regime in comparison to those faster-growing economies in North America, in Asia Pacific. And I just wonder if there's sufficient time spent on saying to the government, well, you might have this relief to do that, but why not have looked to align the relief with what they might have in a Singapore or the USA or wherever, that seems to, the proof of the pudding is in the eating, and that seem to manage to get their economy to grow faster than the UK and the EU27.
Yeah, I think you've asked, well, you know, two excellent questions. Just to, so firstly, thank you for watching. It's all good for insomnia, if nothing else. And there's always another channel you can turn over to, should you disagree. And I think you're right. What's been very interesting for me, I was on the Select Committee very briefly at the start of my parliamentary career, and then I became a PPS to a minister in the relevant department, so I had to come off. But what's been interesting going back is actually how, when you're actually working as a committee, you kind of forget where people are coming from in terms of politics. Not always, but most of the time. And you're working as a committee together in terms of the questioning and trying to follow each other up. And I think that's something that hopefully witnesses and other people watching appreciate. And particularly when you've got somebody like a TSB or a genuinely sort of information gathering session in front of you, it doesn't really matter what your political view is. Actually, you just want to get at the truth or genuine useful nuggets of information for your inquiry or for the people who are watching. And I think you're right. I mean, I'm sure that probably we haven't spent, and I can't speak for Andrew, my predecessor committee, but I'm sure there's more that could be done in terms of looking at how competitive we are. I'm quite keen, as I say, to look again, we'll start with VAT, but you know, how tax policy is made, is it sticking to the principles? This whole issue of competitiveness, I mean, it's going to come up more and more. If we're going to make global Britain a reality, then actually thinking about our competitive place in the world in a whole manner of different areas is going to be very important. You know, this is where comparisons with overseas, again, having really excellent evidence coming in, because we can't travel around the world, nor would people want us to, taxpayers' expense, gathering evidence. So again, having input from people around the world is really, or professionals with experience of advising companies perhaps around the world, is really important. The one thing I would just say is that there is a fine line to be trodden by the committee between making recommendations to government about things that have been, you know, announced or things we think the government are doing, and making policy ourselves. You know, we are not a policy-making body, but we can, I suppose, nudge Treasury, HMRC and others in direction. So, for example, the staircase tax, the so-called staircase tax, might be a good example of that, where it had come out of a court case. The FSB picked it up, I'm sure others as well, but the FSB particularly picked it up very quickly last summer and contacted me and other committee members. So we were able to ask the Chancellor. He was then able to confirm that actually he thought it was something that needed to be tackled, and it was reflected in the Finance Act. And I think I'd like to think that's a way that the committee, with outside bodies and with government, can really make a positive difference to people. But we're always in the market for listening to new ideas and comparisons with other countries, absolutely.
Maya, competitiveness internationally, anything you want to add to that in terms of the work you see around the world?
Sorry, I wasn't prepared for that question.
That's all right. That's all right.
My mind has gone blank.
That's okay. Next question. Christine? Charlotte, sorry.
It's okay. Charlotte Barber, Institute of Chartered Accountants. It's quite an interesting conversation around the competitiveness, yeah. Because I sometimes think if you're overly competitive on the economic side, individuals end up paying more tax. And I know there's some theoretical discussions that ultimately it's always individuals, so just go for income tax. But it looks awfully unfair, especially if you're in the SME sector. Mm. And, well, that's just a comment, not a question.
Thank you for that. And I think you're right, which is the balance between, and I think all the panel have talked about the public debate and public engagement and fairness and people. I think Maya said, I think it was about people aren't so reliant on experts anymore. People want to be engaged. You know, what's happened with social media, and it's not just in tax policy, it's in all sorts of different areas of life. People don't want to be told anymore. They want to have an opinion. They want be able to express their opinion to people who are making decisions and to know that they're listened to. That's not always easy to reconcile, but you're absolutely right, that balance between businesses and individuals. And I think it's worth asking sometimes, do we have our business tax regime right? So corporation tax relies on businesses obviously making profits. But of course, if you're trying to encourage SMEs, there are other taxes, potentially things like business rates, where actually help with those would make a much bigger difference to businesses. So I have had some business organisations come to me and say, actually, continually cutting the corporation tax rate, is that doing what we want it to do? And that, again, is absolutely a question that the committee can ask.
Judith?
Do you know everybody by their first name in the audience?
I can't.
Judith Friedman. I wonder whether you think that the scope of your committee and the powers of your committee and its interaction with the Public Accounts Committee allow you to have proper scrutiny over HMRC, or whether there are any gaps.
Well, there may well be gaps, and if there are people, I'm not sure HMRC will ever tell us where the gaps are in their scrutiny. So if other people spot it, then I think Meg and I would be very interested to know about it. And I think there has been a bit of a shift in this Parliament, and I think all committees have to work out their relationship with the other committees, particularly when something like HMRC, which obviously is accountable to us because it's a body sort of accountable to the Treasury. But obviously the Public Accounts Committee have a huge interest in what the HMRC is up to and the decisions that they're taking and everything else. And I think the honest truth is we're still trying to work out that relationship. And there may have been times in the past when the Treasury Select Committee wasn't as active in scrutinising HMRC because we were busy, or they were busy doing other things, and we're trying to potentially write that balance. And I think the subcommittee can help in that as well. And John Mann is taking some of the perhaps the more detailed work first, with bodies like HMRC, but also other bodies like the Crown Estates and the Valuation Office, and seeing what we can unearth there, and there may then be issues that want to come back to the main committee. But we're always in the business, as I say, if there are people come before us. We have this all the time with the Financial Conduct Authority and with a little bit with the Bank of England, perhaps more with the Chancellor. People will contact me, the committee members, and say, we see you've got so-and-so coming before you. This is an issue that is really live and that, you know, we'd like to. And sometimes we can ask the questions and sometimes we can't. But we will always absolutely look at what is suggested to us.
Tina?
Hi, Nikki. I'm Tina Riches. I recently retired from one of the large accountancy firms. I'm now helping TaxAid, hopefully get ready for making tax digital if it ever comes in. And you mentioned the Treasury Committee sort of supports, or the CIT's aim of a better tax system resonates with the Treasury Committee. I wondered if there were any things you thought that Parliament and HMRC and the profession and bodies like TaxAid could do to help make the tax system better for those that fall down the cracks. Just in the last few weeks, I've seen some horrendous cases where people end up with penalties that just pile up and up, and all they can do is put their head in the sand. They just cannot face, you know, getting in touch with HMRC because they fear what the consequences will be.
Yeah. I think it's a really good question. I mean, undoubtedly things like having a simpler tax system, the point here about obviously education, but in terms of specific things that can be done, if there are obvious simplifications or obvious cases, I think all of us as members of Parliament will, and this is where, again, the committee can help, which is if there are things that people are constantly coming to us about. I'm trying to think if there's anything with HMRC. Perhaps I haven't seen that example in the way. Perhaps an analogous example was the passport office. I mean, it might be the HMRC, but let's say passport office. So a couple of years ago, we all started getting one or two cases of people not being able to get their passports, and then it turned into a flood. And what had happened was that I think there had been a resourcing issue at the passport office, and they'd moved some people somewhere else, and it was about this time of year, and everybody had thought, oh, I'm going on holiday, I better get that passport renewed. They'd sent passports in, and the whole thing just came to a juddering halt. And so what happened was that, you know, we all spotted this in our casework and everything. Went to the minister, James Brockenshire, who was then the immigration minister, they responded, they got it, you know, okay. And there may well, I think, certain things like HMRC. So in terms of just customer service, which I think before you even get into understanding tax policy, you're absolutely right. There is a reluctance to or a worry about calling HMRC. Firstly, I'm going to have a conversation I don't understand. And in fact, I'm not even sure what questions to actually ask. And then I'm going to have to potentially sit on the phone and wait for the call to be answered for 45 minutes, which I can't do at my workplace of work or whatever it is. So I'm just not going to make the call. So eventually they'll come and beat a path to your door, TaxAid, or MPs. I've had people turning up at my surgeries with a carrier bag full of brown envelopes, and they say, I can't open these. So my poor assistant, that's what we do, sits there and, you know, opens them all for her. And we say, we will contact HMRC, MPs have a helpline, everything else. So I think in terms of making sure you're relaying, if you're seeing patterns happening of particular issues that people are falling foul of, particular customer service, poor performance, that's exactly what we would like to know, because we absolutely will ask the chief executive of HMRC, you know, if there's a problem emerging, what's going on. And if he's not come before us, then I will write him a very public letter about it.
Jeremy.
We've heard mention of PCRT, which I strongly disagree with, because it strikes me as being contrary to the rule of law. But it does raise an issue, which I think one quite often sees, that the revenue take the view that they should literally apply the law and don't apply the spirit. And it does strike me that if we're going to preach to taxpayers and professionals saying that they should abide by the spirit, there is actually some obligation on the Inland Revenue to act likewise, and possibly there ought to be a body that you can appeal to say, well, this really, even if it is literally the law, isn't actually the spirit of the law, and someone ought to be exerting some pressure on HMRC to act in that spirit.
Well, I think Heather might have a view on that, but let me, Heather, you answer, and I'll come back. I'll go on.
Yeah. I think part of the difficulty, I'm sorry to say, does partly come from the parliamentary scrutiny, that HMRC was so beaten up over what perceived to be sweetheart deals that now they have a huge amount of governance. The Wilkinson case has taken away the ability to apply extra statutory concessions. Yeah. So perhaps there is room for Parliament to give HMRC publicly a bit more leeway to apply the spirit of the law where it's a hard case, an unrepresented taxpayer. Perhaps what we need is an anti-GAR panel where the tax result for the taxpayer is so obviously unfair that HMRC ought to be allowed to give relief, if necessary, scrutinised by an anti-GAR panel.
I will take that as a submission to the Treasury Select Committee.
Well, I suppose I would add that concern over too many tax inspectors applying the spirit of the law and deciding to take half has got us to where we are today. So I'm not sure it would work, Jeremy, to be honest. I think we need to keep campaigning with HMRC to ensure that it applies discretion where it has discretion to do so. I do think, looking back on Wilkinson, that there was a lot of silly comments made as regards the extent to which that bound the revenue's hands in any particular situation. And I still firmly believe that in any particular case, HMRC does have sufficient discretion to be able to come to resolution, as long as it can say that it's doing it on a principled basis. Good. Ah, we'll take one from the back, I think, yeah? And then Glenn.
Can I just follow on? Kevin Slevin, just follow on. Would you say it would be unreasonable for HMRC to deny a relief that would have been proper in all respects except for the person was killed in a car crash before he filed the claim? This is the actual law as interpreted by HMRC on a particular loss relief. The taxpayer had died before making the claim, and the revenue said that the personal representatives of the deceased were not entitled to make the claim, even though they accepted the claim was valid, had he lived to make it. It was in date in all respects. I just mentioned that, not that I was involved in it, but it is a reported case. The revenue there said, post-Wilkinson, no chance. We cannot exercise any flexibility whatsoever. Food for thought.
It is food for thought. I mean, I think there is always this issue about the, say, the regulation or the law. How far does the pendulum swing? I think there is I take you know, Ray's experience and what Heather is saying, and there is a debate just generally about how much discretion people have, and I think one of the great frustrations that not just in tax policy but many areas, you're trying to deal with the state, with large organisations, is that and I take Heather's point, I think it's well made, which is actually it's not parliamentary scrutiny but also just scrutiny in the court of public opinion. You know, when you see something where you think somebody was started off by using sensible discretion but it ends up on the front page of the Daily Mail, that's not where anybody wants to be. So people stop using discretion because they can hide behind them. This is the law or the regulation, and I've acted completely in accordance with it. But I think you're right to remind us that can produce some extremely anomalous results. I'll probably get into trouble if I express an opinion on a particular case, so I shall refrain from doing so. But I think your challenge is well made.
Can I just say the issue I was talking to?
Well, you say that, but that may well be right, and you're absolutely right to say, obviously, ministers will sometimes, you know, send down, or there'll be an interpretation. In my experience as a minister, it's extraordinary how many people can interpret what you thought was a fairly obvious statement in an extraordinary way, and then, as I say, you're confronted with it on the front page of the Daily Mail or in the Andrew Marr interview, but your official's done this, what? You know, and I've got some great examples of all of that. But there are, interestingly, so Philip Hammond has just, the Treasury has just approved a big change in public policy, social policy, which is going to result in less money coming to the Treasury, which is the fixed odds betting terminal. But I think that's a really good sign, and was supported by parliamentarians across the House, that actually there is a limit to which actually you have to say, we are going to forego some tax revenue in order to try to solve, you know, something that we think is a big social problem. But that's quite a rare example. It'd be interesting to see whether there are now other opportunities and other issues that come up along in that vein.
I think it's actually quite a good example as well as to why going forward we need to work better together with government, HMRC, Treasury, and the professions in terms of trying to get the rules right, because I think what we're looking in your case, Kevin, or that case you referred to, is a situation where the rules just don't work the way most people would expect them to work and would want them to work. Mm. And it's over the entire time I've been working in tax, it's something that's always sort of driven me crazy, is the number of situations where you have to claim something which no sensible person would ever not claim. And, you know, it forces people to take tax advice, and we end up with a tax system which is full of traps for the unwary. Mm. And at the same time, we've got HMRC sort of trying to suggest to taxpayers that they don't need advisers and so on. And yet, anyone with any complexity in their tax affairs who doesn't have an advisor, I think, is just taking an enormous risk. I think it's as simple as that. And we need to identify those types of situations and put them to government that the rules don't work properly in this way. And they'll be even more serious situations where they just don't work right. We had the one a couple of years ago involving the chargeable events, where that chap was made bankrupt because of silly transactions involving something which everybody could see what the right answer was but couldn't do it because the law didn't allow it. I think we've probably got time for about one more question. Glyn? Better let my deputy in.
Yes, Glyn Fulilove, I've been raised deputy for almost 2 hours now, and I think so far this administration is going extremely well. The question, I think Stella may have a view from her citizens' juries, and I'm sure Nikki will have a view, but if a party actually came forward at the next election with a proper higher tax manifesto, not saying, you know, this section or this business is going to pay more, but actually you're all going to pay more tax to finance more public services, would they have a chance of being elected?
Stella, you can go first.
We actually tested that. One of our scenarios was to test that, and it was remarkable. We expected everybody to assume that actually they would pay more, because lots of different evidence demonstrates that people would do that. But as boring as it sounds, the overriding feedback that we got from the different scenarios that we tested, that people actually thought the current system was pretty much right. So despite the fact that we need more money for different types of services, and everybody agreed with that, they actually didn't think there was any, there wasn't an fair or appropriate way to try and raise revenue that, that we're not already doing. So the feedback was overwhelmingly that rather than trying to create new ways of raising taxes, can't we just fix the ways that we've got at the moment and get them to work better?
Yeah, I mean, of course, it's difficult to know, to explain to people. I think Maya said at the beginning that there is a belief that there is still, I mean, there is, of course, there is tax avoidance and evasion, but it's not as easy as just saying we're just going to close all those loopholes and that's it, we're going to plug all of our public finance gaps. I would say from my conversations on doorsteps that people like the idea, and it depends, I think, on how long one particular party has been in, what people see in terms of spending on public services and everything else. I think if a party came forward with a very specific proposal about ring-fencing a particular budget, particularly, I suspect, in relation to the NHS or social care, that may well find, you know, some public favour. But if it was a general, very open, we are going to increase income tax for everybody by this amount, I do think that would still be a bit of a struggle, actually, for a party to be that honest and to be elected on that platform.
Thank you. Well, I mean, I've enjoyed that. I don't know whether anyone wants to make one very last quick comment, if you're bursting into...
I repeat a suggestion I've made many times before. The best way to simplify the tax system would be if all MPs had to do their own tax return.
We do.
Using only HMRC's telephone helpline when they get stuck.
Stella? No. Maya?
No.
Okay. I'll start at the other end. Can I thank Stella Amos? Heather Self? Maya for starting? And of course, Nicky Morgan. And that concludes the Chartered Tax Advisors' address. There are drinks and canapés to be served in some place next door. I hope you'll all join me there, and I'll see you there in a few moments. Thank you.
Very good.
Thanks. Pleasure.